Welcome to Biceps and Banter with expert trainer Brandon Crow. Hold on to your dumbbells and get ready for this conversational style podcast focused on interesting everyday dribble with tasty tidbits of health-related information sprinkled in. Enjoy.
For those that don't know, who are you, where are you from, and like, what's your brief bio?
Okay, so my name's Sarah, and I've been teaching yoga since 2012, but really I had no intention of ever teaching yoga. I'm actually a scientist. I did my undergrad at U of T. I have a master's in neuroscience, and my research is mainly in recovery from brain injury. And brain injury can be like anything. It can be like depression. It can be like somebody feeling disconnected from the way that they once felt. And in my research, I found that people who had body awareness and were able to physically work out, and people that were able to do pranayama, like controlled breathing, which is what we do in yoga, recovered way faster, more efficiently than anybody else. So I thought, oh my God, this is some kind of a magic thing, and I want to be a part of it. So that's my bio.
That's really cool. What was your thesis on?
My thesis was on the factors that affect short and long-term recovery and return to work in patients that have mild to moderate traumatic brain injury. And so you know already that I was a soldier, and a lot of my soldier buddies would come back from overseas with brain injuries. So it just kind of like was the organic thing for me to go and study. It's like, how can I help my buddies, you know?
So we went to school. So you got a degree or a diploma?
I was in school for like 10 years.
Wow.
I have a bachelor's degree, a double major, so I studied two different things, neuroscience and behavioral psychology. And then from there, like, I was always really good at school, so it wasn't that hard for me to get funding. So when I like was offered really big grant to do my master's on brain injury, I like knew it was the next step to go, like, you know, do this research. And I worked with like hockey players. I worked with construction workers that have been injured at work and then, you know, like can't go back to work because their head shook, literally their brain shook in their head, and all of the connections and neuronal networks they had built was now disconnected or distorted. So it's like, you're looking for yourself, but what you find is a mangled version of you or a different version of you, right? Where you can no longer process information the same way. For example, sounds could be way louder, quieter. Standing and looking at somebody, their form or silhouette might be expansive or tiny. You know, so your actual perception of reality is altered. And that causes depression because now you can't really relate to the things that you once were able to relate to. And when you're depressed, it's hard to work out, right? It's hard to like feel good. It's hard to want to return back to work. So we kind of studied, like we asked people, interviewed them, and then did like a survey and asked them questions like, okay, how did you approach your recovery? What did you do? What was your physical regimen? What was like your psychological regimen? Like, how did you deal with these things? Did you go see a therapist? Was your family supportive? And commonsensically, people that had a more supportive family or jobs that were willing to like be cool about their situation and give them more time, they recovered faster, they went back to work faster, they stayed healthier, and like improved from there, and then others didn't.
Mm-hmm. And did you find that like the exercise was a big factor?
It was one of the, so when you do research, you plug in numbers and then you like calculate what variable is significant, like what variable is a determining factor. And physical exercise and breathing, like people that had done pranayama, controlled breathing, and meditation were like up there. They were way more significant than, say, for example, somebody who had like their wife supported them. you know, but mm-hmm. in conjunction, all of these factors were significant, but mm-hmm. physical exercise and especially breathing, something to enhance your focus, mindfulness, was a huge determining factor. It played a significant role in recovery.
How much recovery could they get, or does it depend on how severe the trauma was to the brain?
It depends on how severe the trauma was, and then it depends on how you view yourself post-trauma. So if you victimize yourself or feed into that kind of like idea that you're not whole or complete, that there's something wrong with you, these things really were significant in not allowing people to recover.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then after school, when did you get into training with the Army then?
So I joined the Army when I was 16. They put me through university, and I basically worked on weekends with the Army, and on weekdays I was a student, and I worked at different labs at U of T. And just the training was in conjunction with school always, until I graduated and I was training to go overseas and all that sort of stuff. And then when I got an offer for my master's, that's what I started doing. I just like went back to school because it was like the healthiest thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I got out of school, I like didn't really see the significance of staying in the military. Like my husband and I wanted to have a baby, and we were going to be separated if I went off for training, and it just didn't seem like it was serving us anymore, you know. So that's when I released, and then I had some money left over from my master's, like to be exact, I had $8,000 left, and that's how much it costs to do Moksha teacher training overseas. So I just took that money and I went to Brazil and stayed a month there to learn, like did the philosophy of yoga, yoga asana, the postures, learned about the tradition, and like never wanted to come back to teach. I already had a job paying very well at U of T, but then when I came back, like I don't do well working in hospitals, so it just seemed like the next best thing to do was to just follow this train of yoga. And then it actually made a lot of sense because yoga is very much a practical neuroscientific art, where you're breathing and you're enhancing your focus, and through this act of awareness, you're cultivating change in your brain, right? Because the brain changes with the way that you habitually behave. Does that make sense? So if you always work your bicep the same way, then your brain network for working in that dimension is very strong. If you now try to do something different, then your brain has to go through learning. It has to build a new network, which is why it's good to be like physically dynamic in your workouts, right? And same thing, physically dynamic in your mental and cognitive abilities. So cognitive flexibility, or thinking differently about things, makes you smarter.
Mm. And then the more you do it, the stronger the connection, right?
Yeah. Yeah, your brain literally, like the more you practice it, the faster that neuronal circuit gets. And it just like stays there, you know, when you're constantly practicing something. And then it builds different and new networks to augment it. It's like being able to brush your teeth with your right and your left hand, or speaking different languages and being able to express yourself, say, in Italian versus in English versus French versus, like, Chinese, you know?
Mm-hmm. So you did your yoga teacher training, and then after that you were called back to the Army for short training, like to train some troops?
Yeah, so what I do is, because I speak a bunch of different languages, and I have both combat training and I have, like, medical training, I basically act as a facilitator, and out west, they've invested a lot of money in creating pseudo villages. So when we were in the Afghan war, it looked like Afghanistan, like with sea containers and things, very minimal village life. And they hire civilians to populate these villages and actors. And we like set up scenarios for the soldiers. So if they have to accomplish certain tasks overseas, we minimize those and test them within a span of 2 weeks, 3 weeks, sometimes a month. They have to go through their mandates with us. So they have to, like, say, for example, they're coming into a village and, like, somebody blows up, right? So soldier blows up. Now they have to go through their medical evacuation and deal with the civilians and deal with, like, all this sort of stuff. So I facilitate that. It's super fun.
When they're going through that, it must be pretty stressful, I'm guessing, even though it's simulated.
Oh, it's super stressful, especially for people that have already been overseas and they have, like, post-traumatic stress disorder or operational stress injuries. It's super stressful, but, I mean, the whole task and the job of a soldier is kind of outrageously stressful. Mm-hmm. Like, you're constantly in a fight-or-flight mode. And the more you rehearse what you're supposed to do, the less mistakes you make. So if you could prevent casualties, that's a huge plus. So that's why we do these kinds of exercises. It's called Civilians in the Battle Space, like the project that I'm a part of. And my title is a field director, which I literally direct the field and the things that are happening within the field. Mm.
How did you find yoga improved, or did it improve your facilitation?
Oh, geez. A lot of people come to yoga, like, originally they come into the practice of yoga because they want to be skinnier, or they want to, like, look sexier or something, right? But once you penetrate past that, you actually start to develop a really deep relationship with yourself. And it's a relationship where it's not necessarily good or bad, but you're noticing your habit patterns. You're noticing that, for example, if Brandon injures his right hip and now Brandon can no longer run or walk his dog or do the things that he loved and is defining himself predominantly through that right hip injury, then that's what you become. You become Brandon with that gimp right hip, you know? So that's what yoga kind of brings to you. It's like, okay, what do you give your thoughts to? What do you expend your mind energy thinking about? And culture has a huge role in that. Our society, TV has a huge role in that. But once you become aware of what you're thinking, how you organize your reality, then you can manipulate it. You can change the things you no longer like or need. Right? Mm-hmm. So if you've recovered from your right hip injury, but you're still thinking that everything is constantly hurting you, and you start to, like, notice that, then you spend some less time thinking about your right hip. It becomes like brushing teeth. Maybe your right hip will never be normal again, but just like you do maintenance on your teeth, you brush your teeth, you think about your right hip in the morning, you, like, do your exercises, and then the rest of the day, you go about doing actions or workouts or whatever that minimizes and reduces the pain you experience, but also enhances your quality of life. So that's how I feel like yoga has changed me, in that, like, even though I'm training troops and at the end of the day, the work is really rough, like, I'm really mindful, I'm really aware of the way I'm speaking with soldiers, I'm aware of, like, you know, where I need to cut them some slack, or where I need to, like, turn it up and fucking swear at them type of deal. And it's really something that I learned as a soldier is you got to keep morale high, because we're dealing with death and destruction, and that's really negative vibrations. So you need to keep your morale high. Something as simple as, like, offering the troops a warm beverage, feeding them, shutting things down when it's time for food, like, having these kinds of things of speaking to them about their, like, significant others, like, opening the floor to have talks that are about, like, you know, how girls are crazy and emotional and soldiers are, like, not like that, you know? So it's just like that. It's like I treat them in a more human way, and as a result of the yoga practice informing me about my own state of mind. Right? Mm. So it's like a feedback loop. I see, like, okay, here is an opportunity to build some bonds with these soldiers. No, here is where we need to be serious, not just being in one mode all the time. You know what I'm saying? Because, like, when you're a soldier, like, it can be really easy to just go into, like, being an asshole mode. And that's not necessarily where change comes from. Like, if you actually listen to what the soldiers are saying, understand the bigger situation, catch your breath when you're upset, then I feel like you can really connect with them and augment change better. And that's like that with anybody. Like, I use the same thing with my 5-year-old kid, you know? Like, if he's upset, I listen to him instead of saying, like, oh my god, you pissed me off because you did this and this was wrong, da 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 da. Like that, like having this kind of like give and take response. Mm-hmm. And it's a long way for me, because like I was a hardcore soldier, you know, like I was a tanker. I drove a tank, I shot shit, like, you know, I didn't fucking listen to anybody, didn't take bullshit or anything like that. And then slowly the yoga practice has shifted me.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. How did you blend the two of those, the neuroscience of yoga?
Okay, so the way I break down this talk, and this is like probably the 10th talk I've given over the past few years. So the way it's evolved is like I start by describing why the nervous system is so special. So, for example, if your liver cells, called the hepatic cells, communicate with each other via chemicals, right? And signal to one another, it's like, hey buddy, I need some more calcium or whatever, right? Your nervous system, your neurons in your brain and in your body, your nerves, communicate in an electrochemical way. So your brain cells talk to each other by electricity. And that's fucking amazing. Because that's how you can react or respond to your environment quickly. So the body realized that it needs, like, through evolution, it has selected for a type of brain that can communicate electrochemically. So what that means is, if I'm neuron number one and I have some information to pass to you and you're neuron number two, I release some chemicals to you, and the amount of chemicals I release to you, the border control at your neuron says, like, oh my god, this is a big deal. I need to let these guys in and I need to have a reaction to this. So chemicals surge in, the environment of the cell, your cell, changes and starts an electrical response, and the electricity shoots to the end of the neuron, the cell, and causes a surge of chemicals to be released. This is how everything works. It's this simple task of, is this significant enough to be active or not? And that's how you build networks, is all of these neurons communicate together, electricity jumps and causes a surge of chemicals to be released. It's how drugs affect the brain. It's how happiness and sadness affects the brain and the body, right? And so I start by talking about these kinds of things, and then I give a little bit of kind of like mind riddles. For example, your body could not walk without your brain, because that's who's doing the management of it all, right? And your brain couldn't function without your body, because there is input systems to the brain informing the body and the brain about the environment, and there's only one output system, the way you move yourself, right? So your brain is actually a information gathering management system, and it uses your senses, your eyes, your ears, your mouth, your nose, like the sensors from your muscles and your bones. And it like computes something. It's like, oh, okay, Brandon's feeling really good right now. Let's like make him smile. Let's give him a surge of adrenaline because he needs to run away. Or let's like make him sleepier because it's nighttime. You know? So I talk about these kinds of things and then move into how the yoga postures put you in a state where your body feels like it's in fight or flight. So I'll give you an example. When you're in runner's lunge, the fact that your back heel is lifted off of the ground, is very intense for your body because you're meant to be on 2 feet all the time. Your feet have receptors that give information to your brain about where you are in space. So already that 1 foot lifted causes a little bit of a, ooh, I don't know what's going on here. Then your eyes are looking down. So your eyes aren't giving full 360 information to your brain, which is super anxiety provoking. If you've ever seen like people that walk with their eyes down and their shoulders naturally come in, it's the same thing. So in that posture, you're evoking a stress response. And through breathing, the act of conscious breathing, through muscle containment, and through just your expression in the pose, you're shifting your own body's reaction to this kind of stressful response. So something as simple as that. And then it could be somebody who has never relaxed their toes, like always has their toes crumpled up. And as a result of this practice, slowly you see they start to ease their feet or relax their hands or part their teeth, their jaw. Like, you know what I mean? This practice, it's a slow moving. It's like you become aware of it and then the process of change starts. So I talk about the asanas and how they shift your brain chemistry. And when you're more aware, you're calling on your brain to function at a higher cognitive capacity. What that means is if you just run without really realizing how you're moving your arms and legs, you're just running, right? Your brain is calculating and doing the things. But if you now become aware of how you run, how you put your feet, whether your arches are engaged, what you're doing with your hands, what you're doing with your shoulders, you're actually waking up the map in your brain that sends the awareness signals to that side of your brain, right? So you're coming out of like unconscious movement to conscious movement. And that is like in and of itself is really, really fucking soothing for the brain. It's like what learning is. So a brain that's constantly learning is a healthy brain.
So putting people in the difficult postures in, say, for instance, like a yoga room, it's more like a controlled environment. So when they're outside, they can become more aware of it.
They can become more aware of it. They can utilize their breath in situations where they're aware that their breath is changed and becomes shallow or faster. They become aware of their heart rate. They become aware of their shoulders, their like the tightening responses, right? Because when you're in a stressful response, your body shuts in and your diaphragm can't expand as deeply. And when you're not taking deep breaths, your body naturally becomes acidic. And over time, the acidification of your muscles, your bones, and things lead to dis-ease. So whether that's a physical disease or you end up with like some kind of a cancer, it's as a result of this continuous functioning and the stressful response. So out of that room, you basically use these tools you've cultivated of awareness to shift the way you are. Like where somebody cuts you off in traffic and you would honk and flip the finger, and now you're like, okay, do I really need to do that? You know? It just like allot your energy to things that are useful for you as opposed to just reactionary. Mm-hmm. It's really hard. Like mm-hmm. I'm saying it, it's easy, like it's coming out, but it's really difficult practice.
Yeah.
And you just, that's what it is. It's just a practice. It's not like you get a black belt at the end and, you know, you win a trophy because now you just like are the best yogi, or like whether you can do some really fancy poses and have gone to the end of the asana rainbow. Like, again, it doesn't mean you're a good person or you're functioning better. It's just as a result of like practice mm-hmm. that you like, you learn about yourself, right?
Mm-hmm. Doing yoga, how does it change? You talked about your brain chemistry and different connections in your neurons. Like, how does yoga affect those things?
Okay, so it's a little technical because I have to use some like medical terms here or scientific terms, but there is a lot of inhibitory neuronal connections in the brain, because the brain is like a little child. It wants to be stimulated constantly. That's why like people get addicted to sex, alcohol, cocaine, because those are stimulatory things. They make the brain a little bit childish and a little bit primitive in their responses, in the sense that like cocaine affects the pleasure centers that you and I share with our cousins, the mice. You know, like it's in the vermin brain, the same things in our brain. It's at that level. It's not at a cognitive higher level, right? So the brain has a lot of like inhibitory connections, and the facilitation of these inhibitions is via a molecule called GABA, G-A-B-A. It sounds short for like something fancier. But basically, when you practice yoga, you build tighter inhibitory connections, so that when you're expressing something, it's more fluid. It's more graceful. Like you can find words easier. Your thoughts are more coherent. Your expression of communication is a little bit more coherent. The way you move your body is more like graceful, like dancers. You know, whereas like if you look in the room, like when somebody first starts a practice and they don't have any physical practice, it looks like the movement can be sloppy. Like they slack their feet on the floor, like wiggle their arms back and forth. You've seen that, right? Mm-hmm. So as a result of the practice, you make the movements sharper. You make behavior sharper. Which is basically what we're trying to do, right? Like, you have something inside of you that I'm unaware of, and you're trying to use words to communicate that with me, or hand gestures, or whatever. Through the practice of yoga, as a result of this awareness building, you can facilitate this kind of sharper expression through enhancing those inhibitory connectors, so that the network you're trying to activate is just that network. Nothing else is penetrating it. So this is like a really simplified version of what I'm saying, okay? Another way is like cortisol. You know cortisol, the stress response? Mm-hmm. People who practice pranayama, so controlled breathing, and asana, practicing physical movements with this breath, have less cortisol response. So they can have a stress response, but they won't release as much cortisol as somebody who's never practiced this kind of stuff. So your body doesn't necessarily feel all of the fucked up shit you feel when you have like a full blown stress response. It reduces the intensity. Isn't that cool? Like if you, when you release cortisol, like your tissues can inflame, you can swell up, your pupils dilate, your blood from your guts and digestion soaks into your peripheral arteries and move to your hands and your feet so that you can run or you can fight or you can freeze, right? So people that practice this practice of yoga and breathing have less of that effect in their body, and they recover faster. So they come back to that stasis, that like equanimity, quicker.
And they're able to do it automatically. It's not something they have to necessarily focus on their breath outside.
No, because, I mean, if you could control the levels of cortisol that you release, then you're fucking, like, I don't know, you're like an alien. you can dampen the effects of the hormone through building awareness, body awareness, breath awareness, physical awareness, emotional awareness in your stress responses.
How long do you find it takes for somebody to get from a beginner stage to that stage that you're talking about?
Honestly,
or it depends.
It totally depends. It fully depends. Like some people come to the practice, they jive with it, they love it, and then all of a sudden they hit something where the practice isn't positively reinforcing anymore. It's not making them feel good anymore. And then they just stop. And some people consistently have been coming, like some of the students here have been practicing for like 10 years, as long as the studio has been open. And you can see that their, even though their physical practice might not look like quite as sexy as a magazine yoga pose, but you can feel the shift in their mental and emotional states. Like people become much more humble, have gratitude for simpler things. They are, again, like more capable of coherently communicating together. And honestly, that can take like years, and it could take months, and it could be like the next lifetime, you know? It just really depends on so many different factors, like the way you've been brought up, how much you believe in your culture, how much like you believe in religion, how much you believe in like things, you know, the things that shape you. It's all about that, because this is a practice of unlearning. You have to unlearn the things that give meaning to you in order to see what it is that you actually want to believe in. Ethically, value-wise, physically, right? Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, for me, I found, like, I joined up in January, and then I think I did 31 days in January.
Yeah.
And by the end of the month, I kind of felt like a different person. Like, I was the same person, but I was able to focus better and talk to people easier, form thoughts more easily. I was more organized.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty cool to see, like, the actual changes that are going on inside me.
Exactly. And again, like you said, like, you were still the same person, so you're still showing up, and everyone's like, oh, it's Brandon. But internally, how you're organizing things shifts dramatically. And, you know, like, a lot of us have conversations together, and through, like, talking about our experiences, we kind of clarify and have an aha moment, you know? And sometimes that's happening on your mat. Like, you're on your mat, something happens. Like, this whole hip example I gave about the injured hip thing. Like, I give that example in some of my classes. And somebody came up to me afterwards, and they're like, oh, my God, I needed to hear that this week, because I constantly keep going around and saying, I'm so tired. And I've just become that fucking annoying person who everyone's like, oh, this person's like tired, I can't like handle this person being around them. And through just saying those things themselves, they've become more sleepy, like less energetic, lethargic, you know, and sicker, like not having good appetite, not breathing deep. Like, so hearing these examples through like whatever I was saying, in their own mind, on their own mat, they were like, oh my God, this is what I'm doing. And not to say it's like, immediately we start judgment, you know, because we're just judgy people. It's evolutionary to like judge. It's a survival mechanism. But once you get past that judgment, like as you practice yoga, the judgment just kind of like evaporates faster and faster. And you really get to the core of what the issue is that you're having. You know, so it's as simple as maybe I just don't say I'm tired all the time, or I sleep more, or I like organize my day better, you know? Yeah, so this is like a result of this practice, so to speak.
And you find people always come to that realization on their own?
Oh, fuck no, no. No, no. Again, like everyone's different, right? Everyone's in this for something different. And let me tell you the other side of it. So a lot of people with eating disorders and with OCD or with like very kind of strict routines of the mind get attracted to this practice, because you can be moving through the asanas, you can be listening to what the teacher is saying, and only feeding those pathologies of your mind. So if you, for example, have a body image issue, you might think that like lunging deeper or balancing on your arms can like make you feel better or make you look better or whatever it is that is like, you know, the not so healthy thought that you're having. So I think as yoga teachers, it's important for us to also bring real life things into the classroom. So I think you've been in my class when we've done like partner dancers pose, and you like you see people are so uncomfortable, first of all, getting off their mats. Second, putting their hands on somebody else's hand. Third, eye contact. Like, it's such a huge thing. Like, people can't even look at each other in the eyes, right? So it's kind of like bringing outside practices of actually look at the person that you're like talking to, or see the people that are coming into your reality. And like when we do that in the practice room, it kind of like shifts you out of, oh, I'm on my mat, I have to be perfect, I have to look like this. Because when you're doing partner work, like you literally are relying on each other. So you kind of break out of that OCD or like unhealthy type of thought, you know? And maybe you bring awareness to that, that like, maybe if I don't do this pose, I'm going to be just okay, right?
Yeah.
Like, if I don't look perfect doing this pose or fall out, like, that's one of the biggest things. Like, people, like, will crunch their teeth. They'll, like, you know, their anal sphincter's, like, so uptight right now. It's like, oh, I'm not going to fall. I'm not going to fall. It's like, what's going to happen if you fall? Like, it's okay, you know? This happens in reality. It happens in life. It happens in, like, relationships. Like, just be okay with it. Like, fall, and then notice how you're reactive to the fall, how you talk to yourself to collect yourself from that fall. Like, I mean, that's really the meat and potatoes of what we're trying to teach, and the asana, the physical practice, it makes you feel great. And it also helps to remove some of these defensive filters we have so that we can get to those really important things. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm.
And then that's what causes the rewiring.
That's all of this is rewiring. Like everything we've been talking about, all of this is changed. When you become aware of something, your brain is already shifting. It's like, say you're in a relationship and like you're a heavy drinker, and your partner, when you guys go to the bar or something, says to you like, Brandon, I hate when you drink so much, right? In your mind, you never thought that this was an issue, right? So you're in kind of a pre-contemplation phase. In the pre-contemplation phase, there is no change happening because you don't even know that that was the issue, right? Mm-hmm. Then once the awareness comes and you realize like, oh, this is a big problem. Like maybe I need to stop doing this. So now you're starting to contemplate things, right? You're starting to see what you're doing and potentially look for other ways of being. Then from contemplation, you move into change. It's the same through yoga. Your mind has to actually become aware of the thing you want to change, the thing that you're contemplating, in order to find a different way of expression. Does that make sense?
A little bit.
Yeah.
It's pretty tough to wrap your head around some of it, right?
It's super tough because it's the brain thinking about itself. Mm-hmm. It's not like it's not a natural thing. It requires a lot of energy mentally to do this kind of thinking. It's exhausting.
Yeah.
But as you practice, it becomes easier. You exercise that muscle and it becomes stronger.
Do you find that's why people are so addicted to, say, social media or cell phones, because they're trying not to think about those things?
Oh, God, yeah. This is so much deeper. Yeah, oh, for sure. And I also think, like, it's rewarding for your hands to be around this device and to, like, express yourself or make people see you the way that you want to be seen through these filters that we're putting, right? Literally. And it's addictive. Like, it's visually stimulating. The way that screens are designed are meant to enhance this addictive quality of like the screen or social media, and like energetically. And a lot of people go through, like, I don't know what it's called, like screen detox. It's like a new term, like for when you put like social media detox, like when you don't use your phone,
right?
And then you become aware, like, you're grasping for it, or you're looking for it, and you want to like occupy yourself. I notice myself, I like check my email, and then I put the phone down, and when I'm not thinking, again, I check my email, like, wait a minute, I just saw this, like, what am I doing, you know? And then, okay, drop in, like, actually feel what you're doing, what do you need to be doing right now, right? It's simple, but it's really difficult.
I love that.
Yeah.
That's perfect. I think that's probably a good place to like wrap it up. So maybe let's talk about where people can find you, and let's mention the neuroscience of yoga lecture that you're
going to
be giving.
Yeah, for sure. So the lecture is going to be this coming Sunday from 7 to 9 p.m., 24th of June at Moksha Yoga North York.
Is it a practice and a lecture?
So yeah, we'll definitely have like nerdy talks, and then in order to seal it in the body and make it an experience, we'll move. So the way I usually do it is like we'll build a little neuron network together and move around and like start by learning in our neuron network together. It's fun. And then people can come with questions, which is great. And like each time people have shown up, a certain theme comes out of it. So one of the times I gave the thought that came up was about depression, and we talked a lot about like a depressed mind and how to recover from that. And other times I've given the talk, a lot of people are interested in neuroplasticity, like the way the brain changes, which is what we're talking about. And so we talk about different practices to enhance neuroplasticity. People can find me either at Moksha Yoga North York or Thornhill for a class, or they can find me on LinkedIn. I have like a pretty radical, outrageous profile there as a cognitive consultant. Can find me on social media.
What's your Instagram?
My Instagram handle is Salehi_John, which is my alter ego, Dearest Salehi.
How do you spell that?
It's Salehi_JAAN.
Perfect.
I think we're friends on Insta.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm putting together right now, because of all of this expansive work that I'm doing, I'm putting together a website, which will hopefully be out within the next span of time that I'm working on it.
Perfect.
So that's it.
Thank you,
Brandon.
Thank you very much.
Awesome.
Hey, guys. Thanks for listening to Biceps and Banter with Brandon Crow. If you like our show, do us a huge subscribe, toss a review on iTunes, or maybe share the show with your friends. And if you want to know more, find us at fastingftw.com. Our Patreon is patreon.com/fastingftw.